This digital recording comes from the New Energy Times Archive.
This recording is copyright 2004 by C.G. Baudet, all rights reserved. The speaker is Charles G. Baudet, author of the book Excess Heat and Why Cold Fusion Research Prevailed, 2nd edition, 2002, Oak Grove Press, LLC, South Bristol, Maine, USA. This talk is given at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology Lincoln Laboratory in Lexington, Massachusetts, on April 6, 2004, at the invitations of the Sigma Xi chapter of Hanscom Air Force Research Center and of the Life Members Group of the IEEE Boston chapter. The paper is entitled Progress in Cold Fusion Research. NewEnergyTimes.com is pleased to present Mr. Charles Baudet.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and my thanks to the Sigma Xi chapter at Hanscom Air Force Research Center and the IEEE Life members for sponsoring this event. It's an honor to be invited to speak to such a sophisticated audience. And I guess Paul Carr's not here, but I want to thank him and Ed Alschuler for diligence in making this happen and for that kind introduction. So we're here to talk about progress and promise in cold fusion research. I'd like to start by saying the original promise of March 1989, when it was announced, still holds. Deuterium still looks like the fuel that is consumed in the production of energy. It is still largely free of any sort of radiation that is harmful or dangerous. And so the original promise still holds. It looks, of course, too good to be true. And that's one of the big problems with it. It looks like a real trap for the unwary scientist, and one has to approach it with all of the care that one can muster. The Department of Energy is now going to undertake a review of the field for the first time since 1989, and those working in the field are very pleased with that. Just to touch on something you once knew and maybe know well, hydrogen's the lightest element with one proton in its nucleus. About one in every 6,000 atoms of hydrogen is heavy hydrogen. It has a proton and a neutron. And it's sufficiently important that it has its own name. It's called deuterium, and the nucleus is called a deuteron. Deuterium is heavy hydrogen. And when water is made with it, it's called D2O and heavy water. It's about 10% heavier than ordinary water. The fusion of two deuterium atoms together to make one helium atom will release about 10 million times the energy released by two hydrogen atoms in combustion. For four decades, there's been, as you all know, a hot fusion program, but to a considerable extent, it's been ensnared by significant technical problems. Am I about to prove to you that excess heat or cold fusion really exists? If that's what you want, I'm afraid you'll have to dedicate more than 1 hour to the project. You'll have to gather together a few dozen of the best papers in the field. You'll have to digest them. You may want to call the scientists who wrote them and talk with them about their experiment to see if it holds up under your examination. And when you finish that process, you'll have gone through what the people working in the field today have gone through. The reason they work in the field is they have examined the papers, and they are persuaded that excess heat really exists. I might mention a website where there's a great deal of original information on the field, the papers, that you can download if you want, is www.lenr-canr.org. And that those initials stand for low energy nuclear reaction and chemically assisted nuclear reactions. My purpose this afternoon is to bring you up to date on the state of research in the field. There are about 200 to 400 working in what was originally dubbed and is now correctly called cold fusion research. But the term cold fusion had several usages during the past half century. Better terms are low-energy nuclear reactions, or more generally, condensed matter nuclear science. And that was the title given to the report on the 8th convention in Beijing in the year 2000. Most of the research takes place in the U.S., Japan, China, Russia, and Italy. About every 16 months, we have a conference. I speak of we because I've been immersed in the field now for about 10 years. The 9th was held in Beijing, May 2002. The last one was held in Cambridge, Mass., right next to MIT, in August. And the 11th will be held in Marseille, France, this coming October. Two countries, that of Russia and Japan, are busy enough, have enough people in the field, and people who really can't sometimes afford to travel, they have annual conferences every year in the field. I might mention Japan has been teaching it at the graduate level in various places for some considerable number of years now. There's no teaching of it in the United States other than the one course that Ed mentioned at Bates last year. So what motivates these scientists to devote 15 years to a field that is sneered at by its critics? The answer is straightforward. As I mentioned, they've examined the reports. They're persuaded that the electrolytic chemical experiment announced by Fleischmann and Pons does not have an error of procedure in it, and that the calorimetry that goes with it does not have an error of procedure. And therefore, they can be accepted as the beginning of a new science. Of course, the understanding is very limited, because once you have all your understanding, you fold up the science and put it away. From there, it's technology. But to open up the science, you need a measurement, something that contradicts what you know. And then the purpose of the science is to bring understanding. My own involvement started, as Ed mentioned, in the spring of 1995. I saw there what I considered to be perfectly good science, as good as anything I'd seen in my own professional career. And at the same time, the public debate that you read in your newspapers or in your journals was political. It was not scientific. And if you go back and look at it, you'll see that. You'll see comments are being made that are outside the world of science. And the question was, how come? Why aren't they arguing the science as to whether it's there or not? So that was one of the intriguing bits that said, maybe I ought to turn out a book that covers both the science of the field and the question of why there's contention. And I concluded much of the contention comes from a confusion of scientific protocol between the fields of physics and the field of chemistry. Stanley Pons, in 1989, was chairman of the chemistry department at the University of Utah. He received his doctorate at the University of Southampton, England, where Martin Fleischmann was the chair of the department. Fleischmann, later a fellow of the Royal Society, retired in 83 and started visiting Pons. They turned out tremendous culinary feasts in the kitchen. They're wonderful at that, I understand. And they went skiing together and climbing in the mountains together, hiking-type climbing, and prodigiously turning out papers for the journals. Fleischmann had an appointment as a research professor at the University of Utah, and they just had a grand time together. Fleischmann had been considering he was the source of all of this, the intellectual source of all of this. He had been considering what would happen when you pack deuterium into palladium. It was known for a long time that palladium will hold a great deal of hydrogen. And he wondered if you packed it with deuterium, if you couldn't get something funny to happen. And he had been about to do the experiment at least once before at Southampton, but the busyness, you never got to it. So in the fall of 84, they put a cube of palladium in heavy water and set it electrolyzing and left it for several months. We're not talking here about just getting the deuterium to go in, which can happen in days, but much more than that. And the story is that in February, they snapped off the power one evening and went home. They came in the next day, and the experiment had essentially vaporized itself. Those heavy tabletops you have in a chemistry lab had a 14-inch hole burned in it. In the air there was particulate matter, and the experiment was pretty much destroyed, and a great deal of the palladium had vaporized. What was left had melted, which indicated an energy level beyond anything that chemistry could offer. They did some elementary tests, decided there was no particular radioactivity associated with it, so this era really began in February of 85. They knew then they had a tremendous tap on energy, which could only be nuclear. There's no other hypothesis. And they knew that it was largely radiation-free. They kept it a secret, of course, because no one would believe them. They turned out all these other papers, but they also designed a cell. The cell is a very conventional piece of apparatus, the electrolytic cell, and I'll show you what it looks like. But they configured it meticulously to do just the job they wanted it to do. After they worked up to an announcement, and there's argument over whether or not there should have been an announcement, I think they had to once they had a technician going, once they had a little payroll going, they had to allow the officers at the University of Utah to know what they were doing. They were in touch with the Energy Department for funding, and so the word was getting out, and it was a big word. It wasn't something that could just be held in a restricted group. They would become the laughing stock of the country if it just went from university to university as a bit of rumor mongering. So the only thing to do was to call a press conference and dump it all out, put it in the public domain, and let it go where it would. Immediately, four laboratories tried to duplicate it, but of course all they had available was a very brief preliminary paper. So they never had a chance early to explain what their experiment really was. But California Institute of Technology, the Plasma Fusion Laboratory at MIT, Yale in Brookhaven, and Harwell in England set up some sort of an electrolytic experiment with palladium and heavy water and reported zero results. Harwell has since published all its source data, and there's considerable indication they may have gotten excess heat. According to Fleischmann, there's not enough calibration information to be sure. MIT also, some people who've seen some of the original data have said that they too got excess heat, but MIT has, it's reported, since destroyed all of their original papers on the subject. The Department of Energy set up a panel to evaluate the coal fusion claims. The panel looked at various experimental work up to September 1st. That was their cutoff date. And it's an important date to remember, to follow what has happened. And they said there was no evidence of any source of energy useful to society. Now let's look at some of the data. May I have the first slide, please? I'm often asked how I got into this, and I wanted to point out the principle invoked in getting into this. The caption reads, since Charles retired 2 years ago, he's been on the alert for some long dormant artistic talent to develop. Next slide, please, number two. It's worthwhile to remember at this point the original claims of Fleischmann and Pons. It represents a benchmark. And you can watch that to see whether those claims hold up or do not hold up. First, they claimed a sustained deuterium-deuterium fusion at room temperature in their benchtop experiment. Secondly, they claimed that the cell generated excess heat energy output that was beyond anything possible with chemistry. And thirdly, they observed that radiation was a factor of a billion times too small for the conventional fusion to be the source of the heat energy. All of these claims are on the original videotapes of the conference that was held that day. So they saw very clearly that the fusion they thought they had observed could not produce the heat they saw by a factor of a billion, 10 to the 9th. Their hypothesis, although they for some reason never used that word, was that there is a presently unrecognized or unknown nuclear reaction providing the measured heat energy. Slide number three, please. At the spring meeting of the American Physical Society in Baltimore, May 1st, Professor Stephen Coolin of Caltech said, quote, "My conclusion is that we are suffering from the incompetence and perhaps delusion of Drs. Pons and Fleischmann." And then, 5 years later, in an article in the Phi Beta Kappa magazine, American Scholar, Professor David Goodstein, also of Caltech, has the following quote, "For all practical purposes, the cold fusion episode ended a mere 5 weeks after it began on May 1st, 1989. All three scientists from Caltech executed between them a perfect block shot that cast cold fusion right out of the arena of mainstream science." So that's the whole picture of the introduction that you saw that was on the cover of Time and involved the president and things of that sort. So now we look into the science itself. We note that Fleischmann and Pons' experiment ran to completion in about 11 weeks. But that was not known then. He hadn't produced his seminal paper that said, this is what we did to get our excess heat. The remark about the mental competence of the two chemists marked the end of the scientific evaluation of what they had announced. Both were driven out of the academy. Pons gave up his U.S. citizenship. Neither the professional societies nor the broad audience science journal had sufficiently mature management to report the evaluation of the Fleischmann-Pons claims over the first 6 years. They all abandoned it. The time necessary for them to set forth their work and for the critics to come up to speed in the complexity of electrochemistry and calorimetry. Slide number four, please. There's been virtually no controversy in the science itself, while at the same time there's been great controversy in the public domain. That is, if you look in the science papers, you don't see the signature of the critics. You only see them in the public domain. A scientist performs the electrolytic cell experiment and successfully measures excess heat. He submits his report for his experiment. It gets published in a peer-reviewed journal. And during subsequent years, the publisher receives no assertion of procedural error in that paper. The report is at least tentatively established as part of the scientific literature. Slide number five, please. However, let that same scientist try to use a government auditorium to discuss his results with a peer group, or let him try to patent an innovative cell design, or let the government try to award him a small grant to continue his work. And the cry from the skeptics will be, in the public domain, quote, "Almost all scientists agree there is no science in cold fusion." With that, permission to use the auditorium will be revoked. The patent office will refuse to patent the claim. A select panel will be appointed to revoke the grant award. In this strange fashion, the controversy violates the most ordinary, well-established scientific methodology. Slide number six, please. All right, now we work our way into the science of it. This is what they designed between 1985 and 1989. A few things. There's a bath out here of plain water held at a very, very tight temperature, at a lower temperature. The electrolyte is in here. There's the surface of it. It fills this area, and it's electrically conductive liquid, and it's mostly heavy water, B2O. This zigzag line is an anode, and the cathode is this little bit at the bottom. It's about the size of a pencil eraser, although sometimes it may be 5, 6, 7 centimeters long. Now, this is silvering on the side, and that's to... That's so that the height of the liquid here, which boils away very rapidly, we're going to run a half an amp here through this, Every 24 hours it's replenished, and it keeps the height, which varies, from affecting the calorimetry. Now, what's important to note here is this high vacuum in the Duar. It's a hard vacuum. 95% of the heat generated in the cathode leaves by radiation. We have a radiation calorimeter. The result is the heat leaves fast. That means the temperature can drop rapidly as well as rise rapidly. We have a wide bandwidth calorimeter. Fleischmann marks it as being good to plus or minus 2 milliwatts, which is roughly 10 or 20 times better than the ordinary lab calorimeter. But he's found quite a bit of the 2 milliwatts is systematic, and now I believe it's a large multiple better than that. We bring in plus and minus voltage from a controlled power supply, the positive on the anode, which is usually platinum to make it so it doesn't react at all, and the negative on the cathode. And you push, usually it's current controlled, you push half an ampere through, and then you wait for something to happen. Of course, there are thermometers in there, and there's a calibration heater in there, things of this sort. Slide number 7, please. All right, here we have a qualitative demonstration of excess heat, what you might see if you were invited into the laboratory. The cell is run by a constant current. The thermal time constant for most of these cells, including this one, is about 1.5 hours, and about 9 hours to full equilibrium. And these jumps that you see are the 24-hour points where they replenish the liquid in the cell. And what you're to notice there is that there's no equilibrium. That means that although you're putting in a constant current into the cell, it never decides that it doesn't reach an equilibrium in 9 hours. It keeps, the voltage keeps going down, which means you're putting in less and less and less heat, and the temperature keeps climbing up and up and up. And no matter how you calibrate this, it's unavoidable that there is a source of heat inside the cell. Slide number 8, I think we're through. Now, this is in Fleischmann's seminal paper. It was published in July 1990. The manuscript went in December 1989. That is, they had made the announcement in March, and this was the paper to back up the excess heat claim. I might mention that it was challenged by Wilson and Company at General Electric, and so 2 years later, there was a Wilson critique of it, followed by the Fleischmann and Pons defense, in which I feel they defended themselves well. In this experiment, which ran about 11 weeks, half the energy is generated continuously during that time, and half the energy is generated during this heat burst. The energy generated is half the energy is generated during this 48-hour long burst, and it amounts to 2 megajoules, which is the equivalent of a half kilowatt hour of power in that this is the temperature up here, and this is the heat, the energy output, and this is a strong logarithmic scale. In other words, at this part, we're getting the same amount of heat out. We're generating the same amount of heat as what's been put in. So we have a times 2. Here, we're generating 20 times as much heat energy as is being put in. A 1,500-watt stove burner would run for 27 minutes at cherry red with the amount of heat that's in that pulse. And this is the same amount of energy as is contained in a 60-ampere-hour automobile battery. The science community was completely silent about the appearance of this paper other than the Wilson critique. That is, it didn't engender any comment in any of your broad audience science journals, and it was not picked up by the science community at all. Slide number 9, please. The corroboration of this appears, just move it down to look at the graph, by Richard A. Oriani, a professor emeritus, material science at the University of Minnesota, He's still active in the field, still turning out wonderful little experiments. He was the corroboration of the excess heat. He submitted his manuscript in mid-September after the panel of the DOE shut its doors. The manuscript went to Nature. Nature put it to peer review. The peer review approved it for publication. Maddox said, who was editor at the time, says, we'll let our Washington editor decide. And the Washington editor decided not to publish it on two grounds. One was the experiment is not readily repeatable. That is, the next guy can't make the same thing happen. And this was, that was true at that time and is somewhat true today. Secondly, there was no known theoretical explanation for it. It violated what is known of nuclear science. So it did not get published in Nature. It got published in Fusion Technology in December of 1990. But it's of interest because it's the validation. Now, what he has here is input power. The calibration with plain water is this long line and little tiny dots there, 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 where I put the lines. And that is the, and the output is shown in electromotive force because of the kind of calorimeter that was used, but that is actually the output power. So there's your input-output diagram with plain water with a straight line one-on-one. When you put in heavy water and of different sorts, H2SO4 and different grades of purity of the palladium, we see two runs here in which the excess heat builds up and builds up. At the highest point here, it's running about 6 watts of excess heat, and it ran that for about 6 hours. And you know that there's nothing under the line. There's no storage mechanism. So we have 3.6 watts of power, of, excuse me, 3.6 watts of excess heat for 6 hours as the top point. Again, this did not gain the attention of any of the broad audience science journals. Slide number 10, please. Now, during the period to the end of 1994, that was the period when the claims were validated, in my opinion. That is, after the end of 1994, you could go in the lab, you generate excess heat, but you wouldn't write it up, you wouldn't tell the guy next door. It was old hat at that point. Today, excess heat's been generated certainly hundreds and hundreds of times in the lab knowledgeably, where the scientist said, see, I can do it again. It's almost a commonplace. Dr. McCooper, Michael McCooper, is director of energy projects at SRI International in Menlo Park. That's a firm a little bit like what Arthur D. Little used to be here, a corporate research house. He uses a closed cell, that is, the gases that bubble off with this heavy current going through are recombined and drained back into the electrolyte so that no replenishment is required. The experiment ran for 10 weeks in 1992-93. The constant current input is manipulated. And it's a constant current power supply, but you drive it like this to try to get imbalance, try and get turbulence inside the cathode, try and get something going. Nothing happens under equilibrium conditions, as we'll see as we go along. And he did. The excess heat built up to here and remained that way for about 10 days on here. And this is the uncertainty level of the measurement, this line right there. So that is really what took place. Another one I might mention is slide number 11, please. Dr. Arata is one of Japan's most honored scientists. He's able to work in a building that has his name engraved across the top of it, and I always thought that'd be a very nice thing to be able to do. His experiment uses a hollowed-out palladium cathode, which is then filled with palladium black. So the pieces of palladium are extremely small. And that seems to be an important part of the process. We have here an input-output diagram of one of his experimental runs. This experiment had a peak output of 125 watts of generated power for several weeks. The experiment ran for a total of 3,000 hours and produced 200 megajoules of energy. The average rate of generation was 14 to 28 watts of heat. Slide number 12, please. So in that interval, up until the end of 94, we have here a list compiled by Dr. Edmund K. Storms from the retired from Los Alamos. Each has been published in the scientific literature. The citations for each are listed in my book. The reasons for so many corroborations, of course, is because no one was looking and you always tried to catch someone's attention. But this is how it went beyond the single corroboration of Oriani. All right, slide number 13, please. Now, Professor Mengoli is at Padua, Italy. Early on in this history, was discovered that after the cell had boiled dry, thus turning off the current flow, the experiment continued to discharge large amounts of heat. And that's interesting because you don't have to do any calculations to see how much heat is being generated. It's all being generated. And, of course, well beyond anything possible from chemical effects. This is important in the controversy because the discharge of heat is self-evident. The experiment is turned off, but much heat comes from it for a long time. Dr. Mengoli works at a national scientific laboratory in Padua, and this work was published in 98. The experiment is set up and run at an ambient temperature of 95 degrees C. That is, he assumed ambient would be 95 degrees C, and then he ran his experiment. After 45 minutes, the input current from the power supply is turned off, and the excess heat goes from the 400 milliwatts it started at to 800 milliwatts. That is, it doubles. The excess heat continues for 7 hours on the published graph. But actually, if you talk to him, it ran for 27 hours. Mengoli says other runs have lasted for 7 days. He considers the experiment to be fully reproducible. Its simplicity makes it my recommendation for a starter experiment. That is, the calorimeter and the way he gets stirring and everything is very, very simple. And this looks like something a starter lab could set up and expect to be successful. We call this energy that comes out after the experiment is turned off heat after death. Fleischmann coined the term. Others call it heat after life, you see. So you can get into those games. But it's been recorded in many experiments and sometimes in huge amounts. We have one story from Japan of a fellow carrying buckets of water around trying to cool his experiment so it wouldn't do damage. That sort of thing. Dr. David J. Nagel, before retirement, was superintendent of Condensed Matter and Radiation Science Division of the Naval Research Lab in Washington, D.C. After retirement for a full Saturday and a full Sunday, he took up a position as a research professor at the George Washington University in D.C. This is a summary of published power densities. No, next slide, please, 14. In a cathode of a Fleischmann-type experiment. You see, it started at the announcement time, something like this, worked its way up, 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 and there are reports at this level for excess heat generated in fine wires. And we have here for reference the excess heat, or the heat density in a nuclear reactor fuel rod. Power density, of course, is a very important factor in the usefulness of a power source. Slide 15, please. What would be the size of an excess heat nuclear reactor, especially compared with the size of a current nuclear generator? At our conference last August, we had the first party there, I think, that's actually interested in building a reactor. That's really premature because we don't have the science down yet. But they were from Israel, and that's what they're working on. The detailed reactor design will have to wait, of course, until the theory is established. But we have here things that you'll recognize. This is what a fusion reactor would look like the ITER that's now under planning. This is your typical fission reactor size, and this is what you have on aircraft carriers and submarines. And these are radiothermal generators. I believe Dave means by that what you put on a satellite, such as a radioactive source, to provide long-term generated power. And the cold fusion one would fit down here in the corner because you don't need the radiation protection. So it becomes a small, lightweight thing, and one can imagine it being portable and so forth. Slide number 16, please. All right, please turn off the projector. We'll come to this. Okay. In different laboratories, experiments have produced 100-watt power levels of excess heat that have been sustained for many hours. 200 megajoules of energy we've seen in the work of Arata. And there are quite a few configurations now that are claimed to be 100% reproducible. Now, so far, I've only talked about the original form of the experiment in a Pons-Fleischmann-type cell. However, other scientists have found some degree of success with novel configurations, and I just want to mention them quickly. Using a nickel cathode material in a solution of light water, apparently excess heat has been generated. At the Naval Research Laboratory in San Diego, palladium is provided not as a solid cathode, but as a salt in the solution of the electrolyte, where it plates out on a cathode and brings up excess heat immediately when the experiment begins. Some of you may have read about the phenomenon of sonoluminescence, wherein powerful sonic waves sent through certain deuterated solutions cause bubbles to form and collapse, and to cause a visible glow at the instant of bubble collapse. There are reports of generation of excess heat, helium generation, and tritium in such experiments. Tritium is the third isotope of hydrogen. It has a proton and two neutrons, and it is radioactive. Also, perovskite-type ceramics have been identified with a characteristic of superconductivity at relatively high temperatures. When that sort of material is placed in an environment of deuterium, the gas that is, at 400 degrees Celsius and excited electrically, conduction by means of protons takes place and excess heat has been reported and corroborated in a second laboratory. That's of interest because you always are interested in high temperature sources of heat because that's the kind it takes to run machinery. Most recently, it's been found that if a 30-milliwatt laser, like this one, shines on a cathode that is generating excess heat, you shine it through the glass wall onto the cathode, the excess heat that's generating will jump up by 300 milliwatts, and you can turn that on and off by flicking your laser on and off, and in a moment we'll see why we think that might work that way. So we have here an empirical science, one that's based entirely on measurement. Now, 100 years ago, the question of the part to be played by theory was quite problematical. I've seen testimony that professors would not allow theory in their classroom. It was an abomination, that sort of thing. Of course, physics in the first half of the 20th century was all experimental, or largely experimental. But in the second half, it seemed to go all the way into theory with the thermonuclear bomb and the generation of electricity. And while the measurements that are out of line with current theory get attention, empirical results that contradict theory today seem to be dismissed as experimental error. What I've shown you this afternoon is said to be due to experimental error. These experiments now, up to now, elicit no intellectual curiosity. No experimental report demonstrating excess heat has been published in even one of the four broad audience science journals that we have. to inform the scientific community, at least of what's being claimed and demonstrated at this late date. There's also the technical complexity of the field that introduces problems. The experiment involves catalytic chemical reactions, and these techniques are widely recognized as frustrating technology. You always have to struggle to make them work, but they do make them work all the time. Electrochemical catalytic research is difficult, time-consuming work necessarily devoted to relentless detail. Likewise, calorimetry demands attention to seemingly endless fine points of concern if one is to get dependable results. We all know that scientists are human. They can be peevish over some perceived slight, just like the rest of us. Some are indignant that the two chemists from a place called Utah could seriously question the status of current nuclear science. Others were not given answers when they thought they ought to be and will never forget or forgive. On the other hand, if Pons and Fleischmann would be so cooperative today as to conveniently die, tomorrow I suspect the most prominent critics would say, well, maybe it's time now to give the field a second look. There's also the collegiality problem. If Bob takes a professional interest in cold fusion research, that interest might constitute a rebuff to his lifelong colleague Bill, who's previously spoken out loudly to declare that there's nothing of interest in cold fusion. Over the past 15 years, a skeptic secretly ignored the excess heat measurements. If you look through all that's been written by physicists in a critical way, excess heat doesn't exist there. They're only interested in nuclear measurements to show cold fusion. We have the book, Cold Fusion, the Fiasco of the Century. There is no citation, no reference to any excess heat beyond September 1st, 1989. If you look through the book, you see it's written not to the public. It's written to the professional physicist. It uses nuclear-type equations that most people don't know, most engineers don't know how to read, with no explanation. It's written to an audience who knows those things. But there's no reference to any citation of any excess heat after the original work in the spring of 89. So these are the kinds of problems the field has been faced with and continues to be. The philosopher Karl Popper argued that all discoveries in science must be so formulated, all theories, rather, must be so formulated that they can be held to account by experiment. Excess heat defies the contemporary experience of science. It defies the current theories of nuclear physics. Protocol demands this conflict be placed front and center, and it has not been. So we have a new natural phenomenon of excess heat. And the original claims are vindicated in it. So let's take a look now at what we know about nuclear science that relates to all of this. Between 1990 and 1994, Professor Ben Bush at the University of Texas, Austin, Dr. Mel Miles at Naval Research Station, China Lake, detected helium atoms created during excess heat generation. Thus, the nuclear ash of the reaction process was identified. And it was the helium of isotope 4. Bush and Miles measured about 24 million electron volts of heat energy for each atom of helium created, an amount equal to the known energy release from fusion. Thus, the atomic products of nuclear heat generation has been at least tentatively identified. It implicates the nuclear process called fusion. Slide number 16, please. There we are. The reason for these up high is estimated that not all the helium was collected. So what they did collect has a little too much energy assigned to it in those of those three runs. The helium apparently comes out with all of the oxygen and hydrogen that's being bubbled out of it. So it's quite a process to get rid of all of the other gases and get down to this tiny, tiny volume of helium and then measure it correctly. And it's also been correlated with the generation of excess heat. This particular experiment was carried out by Dr. Ben Bush at SRI International Laboratories in the fall of 93. So you see, it's more than 10 years ago, and the scientific community has not been told about any of this. The dashed line is the calculated energy output for just plain deuteron-deuteron fusing. Now, this sort of thing has been detected now in either 6 or 8 laboratories around the world, mostly in the U.S. and in Italy. By way of summary, of the 3 sets of experiments that were carried out between 92 and 94 by Bush, Miles, and Macoubra, in 18 runs with evident excess heat, helium was detected. In 12 runs with no excess heat, no helium was detected. These were all done as double-blind experiments and measurements. You can turn off the projector now. From the beginning of this cold fusion episode, there were reports of atomic element transmutation. I think that was first mentioned at the first international conference in March of 1990. Reports of element change have continued for all of this time. In 1998, in the Principal Scientific Laboratory of Mitsubishi Heavy Industries, the automobile manufacturers in Japan are following all of this quite closely. In their Principal Scientific Laboratory in Yokohama, Dr. Iwamura ran an ingenious experiment in which, in a vacuum chamber, deuterium gas is made to flow serially through a stacked structure consisting of layers of palladium and calcium oxide with a top layer of strontium. The strontium was watched in situ during the next 7 days as it gradually evolved into a layer of molybdenum. The isotope distribution of this new element was unlike naturally occurring molybdenum, but was similar to that of strontium. He performed a similar experiment transmuting cesium into praseodymium, which is a rare earth element. These transformations were accomplished at low energy levels, something new in physics. The experiment has been repeated 3 times at Osaka University and I believe at the Naval Research Laboratory. Slide number 17, please. This is the principle. You have B2 gas here, you have your complex stack here, and a vacuum over here. So the gas has to make a continuous flux through the stack. And this is part of the disequilibrium that I mentioned earlier that is necessary to make these things happen. They don't happen under equilibrium conditions. So here you have a flux of deuterium. The deuterium gas disassociates on the surface, and just the deuterium, or possibly just the deuterons, go through the stack, and then the gas reforms on the back surface. Slide number 18, please. This is the experimental setup. You have your vacuum chamber here, you have your deuterium gas here, and there's your little complex between them. But now you can see the instrumentation. You have a X-ray source, I think this is it, and then you have a detector. The X-ray causes electrons to jump out of the surface film, and you can detect them and tell what the element is, so that you can actually, in a sense, see the change taking place. Slide number 19, please. Yeah, that's 19. Number 20. Now, these tracings show the transmutation taking place in situ over a period of 3 weeks. 3 runs are shown where much of the film of strontium atoms transmutes into molybdenum atoms. So you can see the change taking place there. And that's the time of it. The change is the equivalent of 2 alpha particles being added to the nucleus. Figure that one out. If you got some spare time. Next slide, please. This is for the cesium changing into praseodymium with 2 runs shown. Same nuclear change. Two alpha particles in the nucleus accomplish the change. And finally, the next slide. It's understood this was a very expensive experiment, the first one. They talked more than $10 million to get it all set up and get the substrates ready and make it all happen. I don't think it was that expensive for Osaka once they saw what happened to do an equivalent experiment to confirm it. And this is the isotopic composition of the new film of molybdenum. And it does not have the structure of regular molybdenum, natural molybdenum. Slide number 23, please. I thought it's worth showing the picture of that rather remarkable fellow. He was at the conference in Cambridge in August. I assume Dr. Iwamura selected strontium and cesium for this experiment because the two elements are important dangers in radioactive waste. When an element is transmuted, that danger disappears. There is here a hint of a method to eliminate radioactivity danger without waiting hundreds of years for it to die out, as we now do. This idea is referred to as radioactivity remediation. Turn off the projector, please. Now, as a last topic, remember we do not know what nuclear reactions are actually happening. So what I have to say now is speculative. This is what you see evolving out of the theoretical work, but it's incomplete and it's subject to instantaneous change. Since 1989, many scientists have been speculating about what might be the source. The electrolytic cell experiment, however, doesn't tell you anything because it's benign. If it put out all kinds of radiation, it wouldn't be as interesting, but at least the nuclear people would have something to think about, but they don't. You look at it and it just sits there looking back at you. So what are they going to do? Well, they start scanning the whole of experimental nuclear physics, looking for anomalies. Does anyone anywhere have an experiment that they did carefully and wrote up, which is anomalous? It can't be explained. And that's what they've had to do to find a hook to work on, the theoreticians. There exist several of these. George Chambers in 1992 at the Naval Research Lab. You see, the Naval Research Lab's been working in this field at a under-the-radar level for 15 years. If you call up the headquarters, they'll say, oh, we don't do anything like that. Of course, we wouldn't work with that. That's a discredited science. But there turned out some pretty nice work. Ed Cecil in 1995 at the Colorado School of Mines. Hirohita Kasagi in 1995 at Tohoku University in Japan have each produced a repeatable experiment in which deuterons are shot at a solid target to produce particle emission. That's what nuclear experiments more or less are. And they have produced emission that is not explainable by current nuclear physics. Of course, it's error, but we move on. We realize it's error, but we study it anyhow. Interpretation of the Kasagi experiment concludes that a three-deuteron reaction is occurring at an unexplainably high rate. You can imagine three deuterons coming together and reacting, but it should be very rare. Instead, not only does it go at a high rate, but it starts right out the minute you turn the experiment on. This interpretation is sufficiently enticing and difficult that a conference was held in Japan last fall. The sole purpose of the conference was the interpretation of the Kasagi experiment. Before wrapping up this afternoon, let me introduce you to some speculative elements of the new nuclear theory that is under development. Two of the leading scientists are Dr. Xingzong Li, physicist, in the physics department at Tsinghua University in Beijing, and Peter Hagelstein, at the Electrical Engineering Department at MIT in Cambridge. They both, each in his own way, seem to be moving towards the same theoretical conclusions, but their work is utterly different to read it and look at it. Both now see a new, long-lived nuclear state, wherein a pair of deuterons are nearly touching one another while not fusing in the conventional manner. Slide number 24, please. Dr. Lee, these are some of Dr. Lee's statements of his work. After 9 years of experiments, there's excess heat without commensurate generation of neutron or gamma radiation. Heat after death continues even if the power is shut down. There are three body reactions happening, which are D plus D plus D. And all three anomalous phenomena imply the existence of a long lifetime D plus D, that is, a deuteron pair state in the deuteron-palladium system. Slide 25, please. The usual nuclear instrumentation for neutron or gamma radiation is no longer applicable to detect this low-energy sub-Coulomb barrier resonance. That is, we're all working below the Coulomb barrier. When you bring two deuterons together, they both have a positive charge. They want to repel. That's the Coulomb barrier. And the question is how to deal with it. The calorimetric technology in chemistry turns out to be the better choice of instrumentation because the energy released in any reaction is always there. In other words, if you're now a nuclear physicist in experimental work, you can't just be good at neutron counting. You can't just be good at charged particle detection. You've got to learn calorimetry, and that's quite an undertaking. It's not a very pleasant subject for most people. It's endlessly time-consuming and complex. This consideration places a new skill requirement on the experimental nuclear physicist. Besides neutron and gamma ray detection, he must be an expert at calorimetry. Slide number 26, please. The process. This is Dr. Lee continuing. Resonant tunneling of the Coulomb barrier for the nuclear reaction to happen was, in past analyses, treated as a two-step process. First, the decay, which is the formation of the nuclear reaction, was assumed to be independent of the tunneling process. This is not true in the case of light nuclei. When the wave function of a projectile penetrates the Coulomb barrier, it will reflect back and forth inside the nuclear well. This reflection inside the nuclear well is totally neglected in one-dimensional models from Gamow's work in the 1930s. Tunneling and decay in light nuclei fusion should be combined together as a selective process. Tunneling and decay, that is, a nuclear reaction, are no longer independent. Can we turn off the projector, please? So Dr. Lee has introduced a fundamental change since the original deuteron-deuteron fusion analyses of the 1930s, which we've been living with ever since. Both the Coulomb barrier tunneling and the nuclear reaction must be analyzed as one combined resonant system. A low and thin barrier resonates with a fast and explosive reaction. That's the conventional reaction. You get the low barrier by using very high energies. A high and thick barrier, which is what you have at low energies, resonates with a weak and slow reaction. The first gives the current Tekstberg fusion effect. The second gives a new reaction as displayed in the excess heat of the Fleischmann-Pons experiment. To paraphrase Donald Rumsfeld, if I may, we now have the old fusion and the new fusion. Dr. Hagelstein has been doing theoretical work in the vineyard for 15 years. As you know, the phonon is the particle equivalent of acoustic vibration oscillations in a solid. We note here that the electrochemical cell, the interface at the cathode, is an efficient generator of strong optical phonon mode in the cathode. Hagelstein has targeted the phone also, shining this light on it, is a generator of a strong uniform optical phonon mode. The interface at the cathode is an efficient generator. Hegel seen has targeted the phonon particle as capable of mediating energy transfer between the atomic nucleus and the lattice structure of atoms in a solid metal where the energy appears as heat. That is, the phonon is capable of moving energy from a nucleus to a lattice work. His current theory explains the anomalous results of part of the experimental work in his field, not all of it. If the lattice structure of the metal like palladium with its necessary nuclear characteristics were packed with deuterium and permeated with a highly excited phonons, then energy could be transferred between the nucleus and the lattice structure. And let me tell you of just one result of Hegelstein's model. For 70 years, the physics community has known of deuterium-deuterium fusion and the high energy particles and radiation that are the result. When two deuterons come close enough to touch, the fusion reaction happens instantaneously. It is inconceivable to physicists familiar with this process, there could be an even faster process that would preempt it, thus producing the benign outcome of the Fleischmann-Pons experiment. Hegelstein found in his equations that phonons introduce some angular momentum to the deuterons. An examination of the equations for fusion from the 1930s shows that they are sensitive to angular momentum, and too much of it will inhibit the expected reaction. It appears that the phonon action thwarts conventional fusion reaction, thus opening the door to some new reaction that is much slower and more benign. Slide 27, please. I think this is my last slide. This is the usual tennis ball's picture of nuclear behavior. Approximately 20 quanta of angular momentum decreases the rate of conventional fusion by 30 to 35 orders of magnitude. This inhibition allows a much slower mode of fusion to begin, one that spreads its energy into the immediate lattice structure as heat energy. There are conditions in which the state is stable. It serves to explain not only the Kasagi result, but the emergence of fusion energy as heat rather than as radiation. Unfortunately, this theory in mathematical form is as yet incomplete, at least as published, so we have to be patient for a little while longer. Can we turn off the projector now, please? Conventional fusion reaction time is about 10 to the minus 23 seconds. Dr. Lee's new fusion takes about 10 to the plus 4 seconds. That is about 3 hours for two deuterons to combine. The density of reaction, however, calculates to 2,000 watts per cubic centimeter of this slow reaction, greater than that of a fast breeder fuel rod. Now my time is up. As maybe you can see, this topic could go on for the whole evening. But we have to get back to our homes. Let me thank you for your interest and your attention. Want to take any questions?
My phone is
on. Yes, sir.
One of the experiments showed nothing happening for, I think, 65 days, and then suddenly something happened. What caused that to happen?
The question here is, why is there such a delay in the early experiments of 89 that you ran something for 11 weeks to see if anything would happen? And the example I gave you, which was out of the seminal paper that Fleischmann and Pons wrote, you see the impulse happening at day 56. And the problem is that you cannot design a cathode for the experiment because mankind doesn't know how to make a cathode with every atom right where you'd like it to be. We cannot make 200 cathodes alike where all of the domains are the same and all of the impurities are the same and all of the atoms are located. The only case we know how to do that is in a single crystal for semiconductors, and that won't help us here. So what you're doing is turning the inside of your cathode, and you're breaking down the structures that are in it till you happen upon one that works. And then it burns itself out. It runs for some number of days, it burns out, and that cathode has to go back to the foundry. Now, Arata has done some interesting work. He's used palladium black, a powder. And that works in that form apparently very nicely. He says he can turn it on and off. He can keep it running for thousands of hours. That's as much as I think we really know about that. But the problem is working in a solid. It's just like the original semiconductor work of the 30s. It's impossible because you can't look inside your solid. Working in a vacuum is wonderful. You put in instruments and they will tell you what happens. What do you do down inside a solid? And you can't repeat your solids. You can't turn out 200 alike and then run them under different conditions to see which work because you can't make similar solids. So it's a dirty business inside the solid. We struggle with it. Yes, sir?
Was there any transmutation of the palladium in those cells that were generating electricity?
One of the most interesting tete-a-tetes took place at the first conference in March of 90, and it's in John Huizenga's book. Fleischmann mentions that he thinks his palladium is turning into rhodium a little bit. And Huizenga goes off on cloud nine and doesn't help anything there. But there are just these different reports. It was not studied carefully, so we don't have answers. Each cathode has its own independent behavior you get into. It's interesting, this question of repeatability. You see, much of the work was thrown out because it wasn't repeatable, but that's a nuclear physicist scientific methodology. You had in, I think, February of 98, in Edinburgh, in biology, the cloning of a sheep. And that was written up in Nature as good science. But it was 226 tries for one success. But you line up 227 jars with Fleischmann's experiment in it and show that one produces excess heat. And you won't interest the physicists at all. Except one. If you look at the preamble to the DOE report that came out in November of 89, Norman Ramsey, who was the co-chair of that project, a brand new Nobel laureate, said, "I'm resigning from this commission if you don't put my preamble in the front of it." He didn't argue with him, he didn't talk with him, he didn't fuss, he just says, "Put it in, or you put out a report where I've resigned," which would throw a cloud over the report. So they put it in. And then he says, if you have only one instance of cold fusion, you've got your revolution ready to go. Because the report is full of how non-repeatable these experiments are. So you do have a conflict between the methodology of, say, catalytic chemistry and the methodology of nuclear physics. How about back here on the aisle? Yes.
Well, I don't know much about nuclear physicists, but I can understand why they're troubled. After all, they've been trying to do plasma experiments, fusion experiments for how many years now?
I think a half century.
And I think the trouble is that if the nuclear physicists can't get interested in this and really come up with a solution, I don't know. I mean, you do all these experiments, and I think something has to be done to figure out what's going on. On the other hand, it's well known that fusion is extremely difficult. I mean, what happens to nature, for example? I mean, I think I always call this one of the God's little jokes. You make fusion in nature by getting a huge gravitational field and bringing hydrogen together, making deuterium. And I think that's really interesting. Now, it's impossible to duplicate a natural gravitational field. The best thing you do on Earth is use terrific magnetic fields to make fusion. Mm-hmm. Certainly, one thing about nuclei is, how do you get rid of the electrons? I mean, to bring two nuclei together, you've got to get rid of the electrons somehow. And on the palladium, you've got a metal, there's electrons all over the place here. I just can't get rid of this problem.
Yeah, one of Hagelson's interesting comments is one of his papers. He says, we're going to take John Archibald Wheeler's paper of 1937, that's the source paper on the fusion, and we'll put it into a lattice structure instead of having it in a vacuum. And then he says, now that may look like something that's easy to think of, but only in retrospect. It was a major step, and of course a very complex one. You had to introduce all these other bodies into your equations. Back there, yes.
Pons doing these days?
Pons was independently wealthy, as you may know. He bought himself a farm in southern France, and I guess I've heard since he's moved to Nice. But he's living in France, and apparently hale and hearty. Fleischman's in retirement in his home in England. He's active with other people, working on publications of different sorts. And he attends all the conferences. And his mind is still running full speed. He's the intellectual power of the two. We had a question here. Yes, sir.
When Holmes and Fleischman turned their experiment off and vaporized their equipment, including the laboratory bench that they were on, did anybody ever try to explain what happened here?
Well, their whole life is now an attempt to explain that, with their cell and with their experiment and the rest. That's what it's all about. He certainly went through the business of calculating the energy and found that it was an awful lot. Question here?
There might have to find this Fleischman's work. There are a number of claims that this cold fusion reaction was observable using light water as well as heavy water. Has any of that been verified?
Oh, yes. I mentioned that very quickly. Using a nickel cathode and light water, one of the more interesting things is that Pomona, the University of California State Polytech at Pomona, there's a physics department with a lot of physicists in it, and two of the full professors set up a little lab, and they do light water excess heat, and they've been doing it for years. They get someone who'll give them privately $5,000 to work on. That keeps them going for a long time, lets them buy a little bit of stuff here and there, working on a shoestring. Well, this drives the rest of the department up the wall. What are we going to do about this? I mean, we've got this heresy in our midst. I mean, and you'd think a department of physics would know how to deal with a physics problem like that, wouldn't you? But what they did was to invite John Huizenga to come and give them an anti-cold fusion lecture from North Carolina. He was retired, and he did. He came out, and he gave them a nice tub-thumping thing, which all he does in his lectures is explain conventional nuclear physics. He won't touch the excess heat subject. And his book, you see, dodges it too. He just lectures on nuclear physics, as he did at Rochester University for Humpty Dump years. But they had a funny go-around, because obviously when you have this visitor, you have to be hospitable, and you show him around, and you introduce him around. And one of the steps was the lab, where this work was going on. Now, if any of you have ever tried to put a cat into a box to go to the vet, you know how the cat behaves. Well, try to get a physicist to win a lab where there's cold fusion research and going on. So, of course, he goes in and they shake hands. And this is Dr. Bush, not the one I've mentioned, and Eagleton, I think his name is. And they've been doing this for a long time. And they say, we have a cell here that's running 12% excess heat in front of you, Dr. Huizenga. And it's not very much, but it's way outside the uncertainty bars. Would you like to take a moment? We'll show you how it works. Oh, no, I have to give a lecture. I'm going to give a lecture now. Okay. Would you like to come back in the morning, and we'll show you the whole thing, you help us calibrate and take data? Well, no, I have a consultant. I have to go up to NRL or NLL, Lawrence Livermore. Well, I tell you what, you're in retirement, sir. We'll give you a fellowship to come out and spend 3 or 4 days with us and see what we're doing. Oh, well, no, I don't think so. I don't think I'd care to do that. This phenomenon, if you work your way back trying to find copies of this kind of behavior, I think you go back to 1610 before you find it again, when in Padua, Galileo could not get his associates to bend over and look through the telescope to see the mountains on the moon. They wouldn't do it. And you find plenty of scientific controversies in the intermediate years, but none that has that particular flavor of it. So it's really quite a remarkable event, and it will be studied for hundreds and hundreds of years as to what happened, just like we read of Galileo's adventure. Yes, sir.
This brings up a question which I find interesting. There are many reasons for people to refuse to look at things and deny and so forth, but among them, in my experience, there have been times in history when the matter was classified,
and people knew very well that something was true and were not looking because it was classified. Now, do you see any evidence of that in connection with cold fusion?
No, I don't. There's a little bit of mumbling about it, and we know a couple of characters who are at our meetings watching very carefully, and they're very knowledgeable. And since they seem to have no connection with the field, and maybe they're in the Navy or something, we can allow that maybe they're watching. But we don't know of anything else at all, no.
So if it is classified, their security is very good.
Yes. Yep. Yes, I'll take that question.
Just to defend you, because...
Okay, thank you.
I am one.
Yes.
I happen to believe that there's something going on here. I have my own models about what's going on. But, of course, there's no funding to do any kind of work in that direction.
Yeah.
So it's something you have to do.
Yeah. Please take my comments as applying to those who are outspoken, those who are being critical, and playing a role. Not all of them.
Okay, well, let me close by giving a shout to the IEEE Lady Departer.
Oh, well, thank you. Very good. Thank you.